Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm on the road today. We're actually in Escondido, California, at Westminster Seminary, California, going to be speaking about many topics. I'm delighted to be here, and I want to introduce to you first my first of a series of guests over the next coming weeks in podcast terminology. We have Dr. David Van Drunen, who is the Robert B. Strimple Professor of Systematic Theology and Christian Ethics here at Westminster Seminary, California. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, and thanks for having me on campus. I know we had talked at Presbytery, and I mentioned that I'd really like to come visit someday. And you suggested coming at the time of the annual faculty conference, and which, for those who aren't in synchronous with us, time is in January every year. And I got to tell you, it's been a tremendous time. I've absolutely enjoyed being here. I thought the conference was very well done. I love the balance of it and the format of it. But it's also nice because in many ways, kind of a reunion of a lot of graduates and also people from the area that come back to participate and get to know one another. So it's been tremendously beneficial to me, not just to come to a conference and do some interviews, but just to get to know the community better. So thanks for the timing of it.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you, and I'm glad you missed a storm back in Chicago while you're enjoying our beautiful weather.
I know, and you being one from the Chicagoland area, certainly know what all that's like, but I did leave, and the very next day after I was gone, there was a pretty nasty snowstorm came through. And my young children, my boys are now 8 and 6, the two older ones at least, they had to shovel for mom. But I got out of that chore. While it's in the mid-60s and sunny here in January, I always find myself walking around just saying out loud to myself, it's January. It's hard to know this exists. But it does. So thanks for sharing it with me.
Our pleasure.
Well, we're going to be talking about a lot of things, and as people may gather, and we're going to do several interviews while I'm here. So we're going to be speaking not only with David, but also Drs. Troxell, Estelle, and Baugh. And I hope into the future we can make maybe a habit of this and come out once in a while. To do other interviews with other faculty members. There's plenty to talk about. I mean, come on, we could talk for days, even just about the articles and books that have been written by the faculty. But at least that's what's on tap in the immediate future. So as you'll see in coming weeks, Lord willing, if these interviews, I'm sure they'll all go well, but as long as I don't have a catastrophic failure with with the technology, people can expect a series of interviews with these men. Exciting stuff. But today we're going to be speaking about a very, you know, timely topic, to say the least. It's timely always, at least in this redemptive historical era. But certainly you'll understand what I mean. But David has written a book titled Politics After Christendom, Political Theology in a Fractured World. It's published with Zondervan Academic. It's forthcoming, expected April 21st, 2020. But David was kind enough to give me a manuscript of it, and I read through it feverishly and loved reading it, took a lot of notes, wrote down a lot of questions, and we're going to be talking about that today. So, Dave, tell me a bit about the project. Of course, you wrote in 2014 with Erdmans, Divine Covenants and Moral Order, A Biblical Theology of Natural Law. So this book, in some ways, is developing a different facet of a theological system, so to speak, applying these lessons to a related area, but at the same time is developing your thought and your previous work and in my opinion, tightening it up in many ways and clarifying it and advancing it in very helpful ways. So tell me about the development of this and this particular project now and how it relates to your previous work.
Yeah, thanks. It's this is really the culmination of a much larger project, the way I look at it. And really, for a good 20 years now, I've had, I guess you might call it a Christianity and culture kind of project. Mm-hmm. And the first big volume of that was my book, Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. The subtitle of that was, if I can remember, A Study in the Development of Reformed Social Thought. So that's kind of self-explanatory. So it was really a historical study of Reformed social thought. And then the book you mentioned, the first volume was published in 2010, and then Divine Covenants and Moral Order really was a biblical theological study in which I tried to think about some fundamental issues of social thought, Christianity and culture, and try to work out a biblical theology of it. So This is really the final installment of that bigger project. And of course, I've got some smaller stuff on these topics as well, but
kind of spin-off works that are, you know, for more of a popular audience.
That's right.
Crossway, right?
Right. But this last volume, you might say, if the first volume that I mentioned was a historical theology, second biblical theology, I'm describing this as political theology. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, because that term is not always used in the same way, but I would mean by that a theology of political community. So how do we think theologically about our political community? So what is their purpose in God's plan for this world, in God's government of this world? Where do we as Christians relate to them? How do we fit in them? How do we think about our responsibilities within them? And then that's primarily part one of the book. And part two of the book tries to look at some particular kind of classical questions of political and legal theory, questions of religious liberty, justice, rights, authority, resistance. So it really is, in my view, kind of bringing this larger project to, in a way, you might say, a more practical focus, in that it's really trying to think concretely about who we are in this world, particularly with respect to our political communities, which is not the only part of our life in this world, obviously, but it is an important part of our life in this world. And it's a perennial issue of debate among Christian theologians and ordinary Christians.
Right.
And as you said, and I think you were saying it was timely issue. I mean, it's an election year, so in a way it kind of works out. It's interesting. I originally drafted part one of this book in the fall of 2016, I was on sabbatical, and you know what was going on in the fall of 2016. So it was during that very emotionally charged election cycle.
Please tell me you took your sabbatical in Russia.
Yeah. Or maybe Ukraine. And so here, you know, now the book is coming out right as this next election cycle is really heating up. So in a way, I'm kind of grateful for the timing, I think, although some people might be so sick of thinking about anything political.
Or they think this is why you wrote it, you know, that it's hot
which
off the
is,
press.
Yeah, which is really not the case.
Like all these other books that seem to be written in 6 months or less.
Yeah.
Well, that being said, I might as well ask it now, but I was fed a question by our friend and Presbytery colleague, Charles Williams. So before we get into the theology, just for the people who can't listen to the whole episode, please just tell us, what is the correct Christian voting choice for U.S. president in 2020?
Yes. I think people will have to ask me that privately and send me a large check. And if they do that, I'll be happy to tell them who to vote for.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, zooming out just a little, because I think it will be helpful for people who don't know you, although I imagine most of our listeners do. But tell us a bit about your educational background and your study of law and how your coursework there. Do you have a JD, I presume? So with that, of course, you're not just taking, you know, professional courses on, you know, this is what this law says and whatnot. There's a lot of philosophy. There's a lot of broader questions of theory regarding justice and the nature of the state and that sort of thing. Tell us a bit about your education and how you feel that that's been beneficial to you to help you think as a theologian about these issues.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I you know, there's a sense in which I was interested in kind of political sorts of questions. I mean, when I was high school, maybe even a little earlier. So I was actually a lot more interested in politics then than I am now. And now I there's a sense in which politics itself is kind of distasteful to me. But I did have some of these interests pretty early on. I was actually a mathematics major undergraduate, but I went from there to seminary, and I was pursuing the ministry. And yet, as I was studying theology, I was very intrigued by Christianity and culture issues. And of course, that's a perennial part of Christian theology, is thinking about who we are in this world. And those were fascinating to me. And I decided to go to law school after my Master of Divinity. I wasn't planning on being a full-time practicing attorney. I was still planning on pursuing the ministry. So it was an unusual route, but I really I was interested in doing research and writing. I'm not sure I even knew what to call it, the intersection of law and religion, law and theology. And I was interested in being a student. And I mean, I like study. And so I wanted to do some more study and wasn't actually planning on doing a PhD at that point originally. But I went to law school at Northwestern University in Chicago. And it's interesting to hear you say, you know, I had, you know, you studied philosophy and history. I don't remember exactly how you put it.
I don't either.
In a lot of law programs, you actually have to work to find courses.
Really?
Maybe it's the
Catholic ones I've looked at. Maybe.
Theoretical. Yeah. I mean, I think you can find you can find some law schools, especially those that have some sort of serious religious basis that will have students take this. But
and you know, as my history, I spent a good amount of time investigating Catholic programs for the research interests I had. So maybe the law programs at those schools tend to emphasize those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And so for me, I actually had to look for those courses. Mm-hmm. I wanted those courses. I wanted jurisprudence courses. I wanted legal history courses. I wanted courses that would help me to think more theoretically about law. And so I was able to find those courses, but it was something that you could avoid that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, while I was in law school, I was thinking hard about the theoretical basis of this. And even while I was in law school, I was reading a lot of theology. I was trying to read a lot of the Reformed tradition that I hadn't read in seminary, and reading some older Reformed theologians. And that was getting me to think about some of the issues that I've been writing about, things like natural law or the two kingdoms, which I didn't hear about these things at all in my seminary education, but they're there in our early tradition. So I was beginning to think about those things while I was studying law. And then from there, I went and did a PhD at Loyola University Chicago. So I had the Roman Catholic educational experience there. Yeah. And I focused and I was studying ethics. And so it was in the theology department. So it was a great opportunity to bring together my interests in these sorts of issues. It was, you know, theology and ethics and law and bringing them together. My dissertation advisor was a student of John Courtney Murray, whom you will certainly know, who is a very important figure in Vatican II, mid-20th century Catholicism. Right. And so,
there's a portrait of Murray right behind me.
I actually joke sometimes that I'm a grand student of John Murray and John Courtney Murray, since I had professors who were students of both of those.
Strimple and then your advisor.
Yeah, so I wrote my dissertation on some issues in Thomas Aquinas's Moral Theology of Law. So that was, I think that was helping give me, you know, some of that, a deeper knowledge of some of the Christian, the broader Christian tradition on these things. So I'm really grateful. I mean, I had not only a Reformed education, but, you know, a first class secular legal education. Plus, I had the opportunity to do some serious exploration in law and ethics in the broader Christian tradition. So I'm very grateful for that, and I think having that background has opened up a lot of opportunities for me as a scholar to have sort of a path to associate with and work with some Christian law professors, as well as to be involved in some of the broader discussions among Roman Catholics about some of these issues. So I'm very grateful for that.
I always think some of the most interesting things, the most exciting areas of inquiry are on the borders between disciplines. Yeah. And I come from a different type of background too, being in business and computers, you know. And so my interest in technology and coupled with my interest in theology is in many ways what kind of started what we do at Reform Forum in some ways. So I always try to advocate for younger seminarians and whatnot to have a breadth of interest. Of course, do your due diligence and go deeply into our tradition, especially those people who we recognize as the great minds that have gone before us within our confession. but at the same time, don't only, don't become myopic, you know, and try to stretch out, try to learn widely, because you'll find just an enriching, I think, in your knowledge, and you'll be of greater service to the church.
I think that's right. It's true for pastors in general. But I mean, for someone like me who's trying to work on these political theology issues or whatever you call it, I mean, it's, you can't just read theology. I mean, you've got to read philosophy. You've got to read history. You've got to read political theory. You've got to read legal theory. You've got to dabble in economics. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's for me, that's fun. I mean, and as you know, a lot of the academy is very segmented. And a lot of people in one discipline, they don't talk to people in other disciplines. But
there's a general suspicion more than just don't talk to them, that they don't want to.
And it's a lot of fun to try to think about these things, to read a theologian in the morning, read a political theorist in the afternoon, and to try to think about how some of these things relate is really important. So,
and then God is the Lord of them all. And then to think about how he is. Let's turn to the specific book. I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on some more of your perennial issues. That's not the right word, but on 2K theology and natural law in general, because that's traced through a lot of your works. But speaking specifically now about the new book coming out in April, Politics After Christendom. And we've spoken about political theology a little bit and what you mean by that, but and we can talk about what you mean by politics, because that's interesting too. But I want to start with the word Christendom. What do you mean by that word, and what have others meant, and how are those maybe different?
Yeah, when I refer to Christendom in this book, I'm really referring to that very long period of time. It's hard to know exactly when you want to date it. You know, towards the end of the patristic era and the very early Middle Ages, when Christianity, in a sense, became the official religion, initially of the Roman Empire and then through most of Europe. Mm-hmm. And you had really from that time until sometime in the modern era. It's hard to know exactly where to put the end of it. But for, I mean, well over a thousand years in a great deal of Europe, entire societies, entire political communities were considered Christian, and all the institutions within them were professedly Christian. There were separation. There were distinctions between church and state and other kinds of social institutions, but they were very integrated. The church was constantly struggling with the political power for influence and for jurisdiction over matters. I mean, Christendom looked different in different places. Certainly in places where the Reformation was strong, it certainly looked different from places where Roman Catholicism remained predominant. But there's a sense in that even after the Reformation, for maybe even several centuries, there's still this idea that we're all Christians, right? We're all members of the church, and it's just a matter of what exactly that looks like. Mm-hmm. And then the death of Christendom really over the last couple hundred years is when, you know, now you don't have to be a Christian in order to live in these societies. It's not a given that the church and the state are going to be integrated with each other. Now, it's not just that freedom of religion is a fact, but even churches have embraced that as something which is good. So, when I refer to Christendom, I'm thinking about that long experiment from the early Middle Ages to the modern era. And I'm asking, what about politics after Christendom? What does it look like as we live now in places that surely are not Christendom anymore, in which we as Christians are feeling more and more like a minority? We're feeling more and more isolated. What we value seems to be more and more out of touch with the predominant values of our society. So
And is that God's intent, or at least is he has, obviously he has permitted it because he has decreed all things,
right.
But from another perspective, what is his preceptive will or whatnot? You know, what is an optimal situation for us in this redemptive historical period, in this covenantal era? These are the questions that you raise in the book. Now, in terms of the language political theology, people hear political and instantly they're thinking like a section in a newspaper or on a web page, and they're thinking of certain topics and characteristics, and basically, as one person said, a soap opera for ugly people, you know. But there's a lot more going on here in terms of what politics are, and we think about the basic institutions that God has established. We think of the church in distinction from the state. We'll talk about what the state is and how it relates to this how it relates covenantally to what God is doing and his common grace. We think of the family, for example. But then we start to think, well, how do these relate to one another? Specifically, how do families maybe in public relate to other families? And how do these different layers of society work together? And you start to interface a bit with, I believe, Aristotle's at least initial teaching on the polis, the city. So explain what you mean in terms of political theology, and especially as one coming from a confessionally reformed position.
Right.
Because yeah. We're not Aristotelian, but at the same time, there's common grace there too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I was actually, I was hesitant about even using the term politics in the title. I wanted political theology, I thought, but even that is sort of a dangerous title as well. And so, yeah, by political or politics, I'm not referring to presidential debates. I'm not right. referring to
policies per se.
That's right. Yeah, right. And so this old idea of the polis, which is the Greek word that we would translate city, is really referring to the place where the various smaller institutions of society interact with each other. You know, we might think, you know, you have a family, I have a family, we have our homes. That's not really the city, but there is a broader community in which your family interacts with my family and lots of other families, and in which we get together and we form we form businesses, we form schools. Mm-hmm. And we also form governments.
And then there are conflicts at times, and you have questions of how ought we to manage this.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so you form public courts in mm-hmm. which you can try to resolve these things. And so when I use the term political, I'm primarily referring to that community, that broader human community in which the various smaller communities interact. And then I would say that political communities, or the polis, they typically have governments. And so government is a part of that, but government is not the only thing that I think we need to think about. And I think this is part of the problem, is that when we hear politics, we think of government and elections and political parties and policies. And I would say that's only us one part of the larger question of the political. And I think when we make government the thing that we think about, it actually damages the way we think about the broader issue.
Yeah, it definitely colors the issue. And I think it prevents us from asking some helpful questions and getting even more helpful answers. One of the things that was really interesting to me and piqued my interest perhaps the most early on with the introduction of the book are the basic categories that you employ regarding really what is an enduring political theology, even applicable and enduring into our contemporary redemptive historical context. And that's the constant refrain, which is carried on throughout the book, that this political theology and governments, politics, etc., governments are legitimate but provisional. They're common but yet accountable. So we have four different aspects, but in a sense, they balance one another. Because we could think of a government being legitimate, but having it in an unrestrained and ultimate aspect would distort our view of what God has planned. They're also provisional. They're set for a time. We think of them as common, meaning, you know, applicable to a pluralist society, applicable worldwide and for everybody. But then we could think, well, how are they to be run? Are they to be run by Muslims? Is Sharia law the right way to do it? No, well, they're accountable to God. So tell me about how you formed and fashioned these different aspects of the political theology and how the Bible really informs and constrains something that is indeed common. It's quite intriguing.
Yeah. Well, as I was thinking about how to put this book together, it seemed to me it would be very helpful early on to have some sort of relatively simple framework to kind of set the bounds for the study. And I came up with these four categories. The exact words that I use actually changed a little bit over time as I was trying to search for the right way to put it. But you know, that first category, the government is legitimate. I think I would say that most Christians believe that. I mean, we find texts like Romans 13, 1 Peter 2 that say it quite explicitly.
Even obey the emperor as supreme. That's right. Pretty strong.
Right. Probably talking about Nero of all people. So, but you know, there are some Christian communities through history that have rejected that, particularly with the Radical Reformation. So I think that's an important thing to say, first of all. And I think it also gets at some of the, you know, a lot of Christians are very skeptical and very wary about government, I mean, for understandable reasons. So I think it is important to say that upfront, that God has ordained civil government for this fallen world. And so government is legitimate. At the same time, it's provisional. And I think that balances the other one, and that God has established government for this present world. This is not an institution that he has formed for the age to come.
You're right.
I mean, we do read, of course, at the end of Revelation that the new creation is a city. But that's a metaphor. It's not a city in the same way that we have cities now. And there's not going to be a need for a sword-bearing sort of government there. And I think both with respect to legitimate and provisional, I try to root this in the covenant with Noah in Genesis 8 and 9, which does ordain the pursuit of justice in this world, but is also in the context of a provisional covenant, a covenant which God sets up for this present world for as long as the earth endures.
And in many ways, in service of what God has already promised in 3:15, which the overarching covenant of grace.
That's right. So. That's right. And so I think those first two categories sort of balance each other, that we have a sufficiently high view of government to say it is legitimate. But remember that we always have to keep government in its place. And then we have those other two categories. So common. And what I mean by that is that God has ordained governments for believers and unbelievers alike. And, you know, this is something that I think most Christians now would have to admit that that's true. But I think it's still uncomfortable for a lot of Christians to think about that. But I think both in the covenant with Noah, as well as what you see in Romans 13 and a lot of other texts, is that government is not just for believers, but that God has ordained government for the ordering, for some measure of justice and peace for the broader human community. And I think that's something that's important to affirm. That's what I get at with that idea of common, but that it's accountable. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, I think one of the dangers of saying that government is, or our political communities are common, is to say, well, okay, it's for Christians and non-Christians alike, so maybe there are no moral standards.
Right.
And what I'm trying to say here is no.
Total neutrality.
Or neutrality. Yeah. In fact, I originally, my phrase was common but not neutral.
Mm-hmm. And you have some language to that effect elsewhere in the book, so that you haven't shunned it, but
that's right.
I think accountable is a good way to put it, because it also emphasizes the lordship of Christ this side of the resurrection, but even prior to the resurrection of Christ, prior to the incarnation, still the lordship of our God over all things. And the covenantal dimension to this, I think, is tremendous. And I know you've been working on this for some time, and is certainly brought more into detail in the book Divine Covenants and Moral Order. But at the same time, here in this most recent book, I found, it may just be me, but I want to ask you this kind of a personal question in terms of your intent in authoring this book. But it seems as if you have received, you know, you've received criticism in the Reform circles from a wide number of folks, and it's been very visible. I think oftentimes it's helpful to have conversations like that and hash out ideas, but Neo-Kyperians and others, theonomists, they're not as appreciative of your position as others. They have a different position. But often, you know, sometimes your position has been caricatured or it's been misunderstood. And what you seem to be doing here is not doing something new in the sense of you've changed your views and now you're coming at this from a different theological perspective. But my perception is that you've taken those criticisms in stride and you've really developed many of the theological themes. Not that your previous books weren't precise, but you know, you any work, you know, you can benefit from criticism. And I found that this book is really compelling in a way where it's so much more forceful from a covenantal perspective, presenting a covenantally informed two kingdoms theology. Was that intentional? You mentioned, I think it was Matt Tuniga, and others that you had interacted with at some of your at some speaking engagements and whatnot, and incorporated their feedback. Was that very a self-conscious thing where you've been? I know you're.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just leave it at
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have, as I've been working on this and writing and teaching on this, it's been quite a few years now.
I know.
And so, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, there's been, I can't complain about lack of feedback on my stuff. And some of it very, there's been some of it very productive. Some of it has not been very productive, but it's even for those who are, you know, who have misrepresented my views for whatever reason, it still does cause thought about, okay, how can I say things in the most clear, in the most winsome way? And, you know, I'm in the big picture, I'm really grateful to have talked to so many people about this in so many different places around the world. And I think one advantage of that is you realize that when someone else is in some kind of a different setting, someone else has experienced different things, they may be looking for something different. They may hear terms in a different way. And I can, you know, I have been in a sort of a constant endeavor to try to say things as best I can, as clearly as I can. And in those areas where I think there really isn't a big difference between what I'm saying and what my critics seem to think about things, to say, you know, how can I communicate this in a way that is most helpful and most able to bring some measure of consensus, and
even to people outside this immediate community. I think that's something. I enjoy speaking with you so much at Presbytery and then our time this week. But it's so important that we would have cross-pollinization. Now, the Reformed confessional community is microscopic compared to the rest of the world. But even there, we have these walls that are built up where we don't always talk very well through them. And then you, in our flesh, sometimes folks can have the tendency to impute motive or intent to something that might be as simple as a lack of precise communication. I'm not imputing that to you, that you haven't spoken clearly. I'm just saying people may not be able to understand what you've been saying because they haven't bothered to talk across the wall. And it's important that we would have these conversations and talk more thoroughly in order to really get at the issues and to learn from one another. So I appreciate that. But you mentioned the covenant with Noah, and that's where I was going with this to begin with. Part of my hesitancy in years past with certain versions of 2K theology, and you call it an older version in the book, is that some people, maybe it's a caricature, maybe some people have advocated for this view, will tend to divide the mediation of Christ and say Christ is the mediator, but he mediates the common kingdom through, this is very simplistic, but he mediates the common kingdom through general revelation and natural law. He mediates the special kingdom or the kingdom that'll last forever. The church, he mediates through special revelation. And that divide, I don't find it tremendously helpful. We'll get into other issues later, but I I see a role for special revelation to the world. I see pre-redemptive special revelation in the Garden of Eden. We can talk about that. But what you've done here is you've moved from that. I'm not saying you were an advocate of that, but you've been very precise to root the mediation within the covenants. It's a covenantal perspective. Whereas we don't have one Christ, Lord of all, and he somehow is dividing up the world and doing different things in different ways, so much as we have an overarching covenant of grace instituted in Genesis 3:15 and then mediated successively through different administrations, that we have a unique common covenant with Noah that, you know, in so many words, I'll just say, institutes common grace, and it restrains God's justice for a time so that his gracious purposes can go forth. God didn't come to the garden to destroy them. He held off his judgment, and then with Noah, after he destroyed the world by water, he promised, "I'll never again destroy the world by water," and that's so that he can call all of his sheep, all the elect may be called in. And then once he does call them all in, he'll destroy the earth by fire and transform it and bring in the new heavens and the new earth. And so thinking of it that way, I think, is very winsome, at least to people who are persuaded of this covenant theology. Anyone who likes Meredith Klein ought to be, and I think is very compelling, and you do the exegetical work. So my point is to the listeners and to the viewers, there's something to reckon with here. And even if you don't like the term two kingdom theology, think long and hard about what's going on with between the Lord and Noah, and what really are the implications of that. What does that mean for us in this world? And how ought we to relate to other people who are beneficiaries of common grace, yet may not be brought into the kingdom of Christ's church yet? So, I mean, run with that for a minute. Explain to me, you know, build the case a little for the commonality of the Noahic covenant and how that plays into, or how that informs the theological considerations of this book.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I would just, first thing I would add is that there are a lot of other Reformed theologians who have understood this Noahic covenant as common. I mean, Gerhardus Vosten.
Yes.
Abraham Kuyper started his big volume on common grace with the Noahic covenant. Herman Bavinck did, and you find older Reformed theologians as well. So I think it is, I think
that's
it's
helpful. Right.
I think it's helpful for people to know that even though I'm doing something with this that I don't know of any other previous Reformed theologian who's done exactly what I'm doing. I'm sort of taking this in some, I'm putting some new questions to it. But the view itself is not, it's not a new, unique.
It's not novel. The structure, the covenantal structure is there. It's well received. I think it's sound, and I think the way you develop it, it's quite interesting. But
so,
explain that to people.
Yeah,
though,
So I mean, as I look at the text, you know, between Genesis 8:21 through 9:17 or so, that covenant that we find there, it's clearly a universal covenant. It's made with not only all of Noah's descendants, but every living creature. It's made with the earth. It's made with summer and winter, seed time and harvest. And we also find that it is a preservative covenant. So it doesn't, this is something that I feel like I have to point out, is that it doesn't make any promises of redemption.
And there's no blood there.
There's no blood there. The rainbow is a non-bloody sign. What it promises is that God is going to preserve this world for a time, in order to that the human community might continue and grow, and that especially so that there might be a world to save, you might say. I mean, without this covenant, there would be no human race in which Christ could enter and enact the plan of salvation. So it's I think this is important. It to say that the Noahic covenant is a covenant of common grace is not to say it's just disconnected from the covenant of grace. We can see how, in a sense, you couldn't even have the covenant of grace without this covenant of common grace, because the covenant of grace presumes that there's still a world, a fallen world, but a world that still exists. But that's not really my focus here. my focus is to say, I think the Noahic covenant as a common grace covenant is really important for thinking about political community in this, you know, in this world in which we live, and that in this covenant, in this common grace covenant, God has, well, he's preserved a lot of things. I mean, he's preserved families. I mean, we see that in the Noahic covenant. He says, be fruitful and multiply. So there's still family structures which are being acknowledged. But we see that there's a broader human community which is being preserved. And we see that there is that call to justice in the Noahic covenant. He who sheds the blood of man, by man will his blood be shed. And that's a basic principle of justice, you know, proportionate penalty, fitting penalty for wrong. And so there's a lot of argument here, obviously, but I try to root the institution of political community and government in particular in this covenant. And that provides this foundation for saying that it's a common covenant, or these are common institutions, and that we as believers need to take that seriously, mm-hmm. And to interact with unbelievers as fellow participants in this common grace covenant, accountable to God with them, alongside them, for these things. And my hope is that by talking about these things in covenantal terms primarily, that will be attractive to Reformed people especially. As you probably noted, I mean, I use the language of two kingdoms very little in this book. And I mean, part of my hope is that covenantal language, it provides a more explicitly biblical, yes, exegetical grounding for it, and it just resonates with Reformed, right, people.
Yes, and I agree. I think it does. I think it's very winsome in that regard. I think there have been critics, maybe they're dealing with caricatures, but certainly people hear the title Two Kingdoms and they have a knee-jerk reaction. And they presume that there just must be a motivation to evacuate the public square of anything related to God. And so there can be this thought that it's a total separation and a realm of neutrality in which God is not really Lord, or it's like there's the deist world and then and there's the world, which is totally not the point of the issue. And by rooting it in covenants and then also understanding the Noahic covenant is serving ultimately God's great purpose in the covenant of grace, even in the Pactum Salutis, is certainly a tremendously biblical and I think a sound way to approach the questions. And it should, I hope, assuage people's fears that we're saying, no, God is Lord over all. He's Lord over the common kingdom. And the common kingdom is accountable to God, even though it's legitimate. Nevertheless, it's provisional because God will come in final judgment. And on the other side of final judgment, there will not be a need for politics in the way that we're thinking of it now, because everyone will be confirmed in righteousness. Anyway, so the other aspect here, another aspect, is and what you're developing here is certainly has to do with nature and grace. And that's a big feature of Thomas Aquinas's theology and philosophy, and thinking of creation and how creation as created relates to God's supernatural purposes. And so the issue here, this gets at the heart of matters of a lot of differences between different theological traditions. And you start to speak about the relationship between nature and grace. I think it's in a helpful way. And specifically how that might pertain to the image of God and how that pertains to eschatology and creation's own telos. Would you say that creation had both various subordinate ends inherent to its ongoing existence and also to an ultimate eschatological end? And that got me excited because I do believe in eschatology precedes soteriology. It's a very Vossian thing. I've got a portrait of Voss, the one that's on the cover of Danny's Voss book to my left. And so for those who may not know, basically what we mean is that when God created Adam and Eve in his image and placed them in the garden, he had a plan and purpose for them that they would advance to a higher, glorious, and consummate life. That wasn't an appendage. That was an original intent. And then he was given this promise originally in the covenant of works. You developed this in your conference lecture. And then he forfeited that by disobeying the Lord. So there's a question among different theologians, Thomas being one, how does nature relate to grace? What are the different, they're little short formulations. Yeah. Grace preserves nature. Grace restores nature. Grace destroys nature.
Yeah.
What are those? How do you perceive matters, and what is your corrective to maybe some misperceptions of the past?
Yeah, well, the two primary phrases that I interact with are grace perfects nature, which is the way Thomas Aquinas put it. And there are also a lot of early Reformed theologians who put it in the same way. A lot of contemporary neo-Calvinists prefer the terminology of grace restores nature. And I think you could use either of those terms to say something theologically correct. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I have something to add to the discussion, it's in my suggestion that maybe we should use two verbs rather than one verb. And I think one of the difficulties is in trying to find one verb that describes what grace does to nature, is that we lose the idea that actually we talk about two kinds of God's grace, or two aspects of God's grace: God's common grace and God's saving or special grace. And so I propose that we might say that common grace preserves nature, while saving grace or special grace consummates nature. And what I mean by that is very similar to what we were talking about with our covenant theology earlier, mm-hmm. that by God's common grace, he preserves this world. Mm-hmm. This world is fallen. It's not what it was originally created as. It's a fallen world, but God preserves it with many good things. But God is also doing a much greater work, and he is bringing redemption, and that gracious, salvific grace is ultimately going to result in the consummation of this present world. God is bringing this first creation to consummation in a new creation. And so I think it's important that as we use this terminology of grace, X nature, whatever that X, whatever verb that is, I think we need to account for both of those things. I think for Thomas and for a lot of the Roman Catholic tradition, there's this tendency to have too low a view of nature, even from the beginning.
Yeah,
that somehow there needed to be some supernatural grace that would take away the flaws of the original creation.
The donum super additum.
Right. And I think a danger in some of contemporary neo-Calvinism is to maybe not appreciate what kind of a radical work God needs to do to redeem this present world. And there's a danger of thinking that by our own transformative efforts in culture that we can kind of bring the present world towards its new creation goal. So I sort of hope that my new formula might provide a sort of a new way to talk and debate this.
Let's let me go off book for a second.
Yeah.
But with all Christian brotherly charity, let me run an idea by you, see what you think. Thomas, just if we look at the motto, grace perfects nature, I can go along with that and with a certain understanding. But then understanding, as you indicate, other aspects of Thomas's theology, which I'm tremendously appreciative of Thomas on the whole. But when we're looking specifically at Adam as created in the garden, Adam was not created, so his nature was not, I'll just put it this way, insufficient for attaining the beatific vision. So as Reformed people, please push back and correct me if you feel the need to do so. But within the Reformed tradition and within Reformed anthropology. Adam was created in the image of God. I very much like Klein, who believes that the image of God has three aspects. It's formal slash physical. So even his body is imaging God. The image of God isn't just something that Adam does. It's something he is. There's a functional aspect. That's the office of prophet, priest, and king. But there's also the ethical aspect. But as he was created, he was not created consummately. He was created good, but not perfected. Nevertheless, he had all that he needed in order to attain that which God held out to him. So God gave him the command in the covenant of works, but he wasn't lacking the equipment to obey. Now, obviously, he was mutable and he didn't obey. One of the great mysteries of, you know, why did he fall? You know, if he was created good, that's a mystery to some degree. But it wasn't as if he needed the donum super additum in order to be directed toward that consummation. And so from that perspective, we can look at something that Gerhardus Voss calls the deeper Protestant conception. It's that inherent eschatology, a heavenly directedness, that there's an eschatology, a telos, built into nature, understood in terms of human nature. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Praise the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't talk about it too much in
this
book.
That's not this book. That's why I said we're going off book.
Yeah, there's definitely material on that in Divine Covenants and Moral Order. I would argue that the image of God as we see it, particularly in Genesis 1 and 2, of course we want to think about more scripture than just Genesis 1 and 2 for our theology of the image.
But 9:6, you do bring up in here.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Referencing man's capability of executing justice in the common kingdom.
But I think it's very interesting that we see, God's own pattern in creating is to work in this world and then enter this eschatological rest. Mm-hmm. And then he makes us in his image and immediately calls us to work in this world. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, we're in his image. We're in his likeness. He works in this world unto a rest. Well, if he makes us in his image and likeness, called to work in this world, it must be with a goal. It must be with an end in sight. I mean, it's not to an endless task of just working forever and ever and ever in this world and not getting anywhere. And so I think we could talk about this for a long time. But I do think that in the image of God itself, there is that eschatological goal. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. I mean, I just, how can you not think of 1 Corinthians 15?
We have
borne the image of the man of dust, so we will bear the image of the man of heaven. And, you know, I think there's a real sense, this is not necessarily the most accessible way to put it. But I do suggest to my students that it's helpful to distinguish the protological image and the eschatological image.
Well, that's what I would say. I don't know if you would agree, but I certainly see the comparison there, not between fallen Adam and Christ, but between Adam as created and Christ.
Yeah,
but then he says, Paul says, if there is the natural, then also the spiritual, which seems to indicate that there is an inherent eschatology, a drivenness of and a directedness of that image of God as created that is inevitably pointing toward the resurrection.
That's right. And the way I would put it is that this protological image, we are made to be workers toward a rest.
Right.
And then the eschatological image, which Christ already has as the resurrected and ascended one, is, I mean, he's no longer a worker toward a rest. He is, you might say, he's a rester looking back at the work completed.
He's seated.
And then in him, we already have a share in that, and at our resurrection, we'll share it fully.
Let's talk about that a little with regard to the book, because another major feature here, and this I thought was very helpful to color more of what you have been developing in terms of the two kingdom theology, but it's the idea of us as Christians being pilgrims. So we do exist and live in this common world. There is an element of truth, more than an element. There is a truth that we are dual citizens. I mean, I'm an American citizen. I'm accountable to the laws of the United States. I'm accountable, unfortunately, to the laws of Illinois and to, because that's, our state is not in good shape, is what I say. I don't have any laws I want to break. I just a little pessimistic about
it. I think the Illinois government makes the California government look good.
Lately, I just passed the brand new cannabis amnesty box at O'Hare Airport. So that's where we are nowadays. But so in a sense, we are dual citizens, but I think a predominant category within scripture is to understand that our fundamental identity, if we are Christians, if we are in Christ, is that he's our fundamental identity. And one of my favorite passages is not only Galatians 2:20, but also Colossians 3:1-4. So if then you've been raised with Christ, I'd prefer the force of that to I take that as since then you have been raised with Christ, you know, set your mind on the things above, because that is where Christ is. So I'm not in the heavenly places locally, like physically. I'm a pilgrim. I'm on my way, Hebrews 3:4. Nevertheless, my identity is bound up with Christ. And so there are a lot of aspects and dimensions that we need to think of this present wilderness wandering. How are we to relate to people in this world? How are we to consider ourselves as sojourners and exiles? Nevertheless, fundamentally identified with the kingdom of heaven. We belong there. That's where we're going. But at the same time, there is a legitimate common kingdom. Nevertheless, it's provisional and accountable to the Lord. Describe that to us and explain how you've really sought to develop that exile theme. For this period of time.
Yeah, you're definitely right that is a very important theme in the book. And, you know, in a way, that's part of the contrast with the whole idea of Christendom, because I think there's a sense in which the whole Christendom project, we might say, was a kind of an attempt to make us at home here in this world.
Immanentize the eschaton.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's, you know, obviously Christians during those times, they still knew they weren't in the new creation. Yeah. But there's a sense in which you have a little bit of the new creation right here, in that you've got this unified confessional Christian society. And what I'm saying is that I don't think that's not what the New Testament calls us to expect as our experience, or it doesn't call us to seek out that kind of thing. We are those who have been raised up with Christ in heaven. We are citizens of heaven, Philippians 3. Hebrews 13, here we have no lasting city. I mean, so you've got all sorts of examples of that. And, you know, one text that I think has meant a lot to me, has been, I think, helpful for me thinking about this, is 1 Peter 2:11, in which Peter uses two terms. He says we are sojourners and exiles. Now, depending on which translation you use, it might be a somewhat different word there, but I think those are good translations. And that points us back to the Old Testament. I mean, Abraham was a sojourner. The Israelites were exiles in Babylon. They didn't think they were running the show then. They were living amidst people who were often hostile to them, and yet they. If we look at the story of Abraham, or if we look at Daniel and his friends in Babylon, we see people who were still. They were still involved in those places where they were sojourning, those places where they were exiles, and they were often making good contributions to those places. And so, yeah, this is a theme that I try to develop to think about. You know, to be a sojourner in a place or to be an exile doesn't mean you don't have any share of the life of that place. What it means is you don't have a permanent home there. And I think that really captures our place in this world really well. I mean, we have responsibilities here. We can be involved. We should be involved. But once we start thinking of our political community or any other kind of institution here as our permanent home, I think we've missed something absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Considering how much there is in the book, I mean, the book is divided into part one and part two, and I find it really helpful. But in part two of the book, which I think... we're going to have to probably do a follow-up to talk about more of the details. But you really start to dig into more of the specific application of things. And so just for the listener, please pre-order this book. But here are some of the chapters. The Noahic Origins of Political Community in the Old Testament. Then you have it in the Noahic Origins of Political Community in the New. natural law and political community, responsible citizens, patient sojourners, Christians' public life under two covenants. Well, those are all part one questions, but part two is that chapter seven starts pluralism and religious liberty, family and commerce, justice and rights, customs and laws, and authority and resistance, and then reflections on the liberal and conservative traditions, politically speaking.
That's right.
we could even say classic liberalism, and we could be meaning completely different things different spheres,
exactly.
Right? So that's just a survey of the chapter titles, but there's a tremendous amount to think about and a lot of things that are really quite interesting. But one thing I think might be a good way to kind of direct people's thoughts, at least as we consider concluding, are some aspects that you do lay out in chapter four on the Noahic origins of political community in the New Testament, where you do argue that political communities in which Christians now live have the same nature and purpose as Gerar, as Babylon, and other cities that you do examine in the Old Testament. How are we to consider that? We've mentioned some of the language of sojourners and exiles, Romans 13, first, you know, Peter's conversations and whatnot. But I think it's useful for us because we are living in the same redemptive historical context as those in the early church. So how are we then also to understand these things in our relation to, I don't know, the context of Babylon, for example? Because we think that's thousands of years ago, has nothing to do with us, but actually the way that God's people were called to live even in Babylon has a lot to say about how we're called to live even now in contemporary modern society.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the argument that I make is that, I note that we never actually have, in my judgment, a kind of explicit initial authorization of civil government or political community, per se. Mm-hmm. There's no one time when, there's no equivalent of Matthew 16, when Jesus says, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so what I argue is that we have something of this general commission in the Noahic covenant, and that there's a commission for us to live as communities. There's a commission for us to do justice within those communities. And that as the human race developed, there is this formation of what we think of as political communities and civil governments. And it's those sorts of things that Romans 13 can look back on and say, these are God ordained, that the human race has formed these communities, ultimately under God's authorization. And I think the same process that produced Gerar, that produced Babylon, also produced the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I think it can be very instructive for us to think about, how did the saints of old who were living, for example, in exile in Babylon, how were they to conduct themselves? How did they conduct themselves? Now, there are differences with our redemptive historical situation. We need to make sure that we acknowledge that as well. But I think when we look at texts like Jeremiah's letter to the exiles in Jeremiah 29, when we look at how someone like Daniel and his three friends conducted themselves, I think we get a lot of insight as to what it means to be living as sojourners or exiles in this age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you summarize very usefully part two, saying to the effect that if common institutions are indeed grounded in the Noahic covenant, what framework does this provide for evaluating perennial questions of legal and political theory? Or what are justice, commerce, and community supposed to look like under Noah's rainbow? I love the way you put that. And I think that really
that was going to be my original subtitle.
Under Noah's rainbow.
Well, justice, commerce, and community under Noah's rainbow. Yeah. Well, you know, it was... Yeah, I mean that actually is that is exactly what part two gets to.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe we can talk about this more if you want to.
I'd love to.
Yeah, I mean, basically what I'm trying to do is, and this is, I think, is important for your listeners to understand, is that I'm not trying to set forth the Christian public policy in part two. I'm definitely not trying to do that.
You're going to have the Cato Institute or whatever. You're going to be the Van Drennen
Institute. I don't think so. But I do think that if the sorts of arguments that I make about the Noahic Covenant, mm-hmm. about political community in this present era, if that's true, then it must have implications for the way we think about these various issues, like yeah. religious liberty, like right. justice, like authority. Right. And so I'm really trying to help readers think through. I sort of invite them to think through with me a lot of these questions that people have been asking for a really long time.
Mm. What might you suggest to people? Of course, they should pick up the book and also read its in some ways its predecessor, Divine Covenants and Moral Order from 2014 with Erdmans. This book, Politics After Christendom: Political Theology in a Fractured World, Zondervan Academic, 2020. How might people prepare? What are maybe some works on covenant theology or just theology in general you think might help instruct or guide people so that they would be able to grapple with and interact with your ideas perhaps more fruitfully?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think any kind of background in Reformed theology would be helpful. I think, you know, there are some great works on the covenants that have been produced historically. I think of Herman Ritzius's Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man. If you want to look for like an older treatment of the covenants, mm-hmm. that I think is still extremely valuable. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be one. My friend Zach Heal and Mike Brown have written this little thin volume called Sacred Bond, which I think is a really nice kind of short introduction to some of these things. So, I mean, those are a couple of very different examples, but both which I think if you're looking for some foundation in covenant mm-hmm. theology, provide some really helpful stuff.
What's on your shelf right now in terms of the legal theory, political theory, whatnot, the more legal or philosophical side of things? And I'm not saying what you are sympathetic with, but what are you interacting with right now?
Oh, well, yeah.
And I know it's probably for a different project, but I'm curious to hear what you're working with.
To be perfectly honest, I haven't been reading a whole lot of that recently because I've been focusing my attention on other
golf?
Things. Well, I'm always focused on golf, but I did actually, I got a gift. Actually, I requested it, but it's a new work by Peter Betke on the thought of F.A. Hayek, who I find to be a pretty fascinating 20th century political mm-hmm. and legal thinker. So I'm sort of hoping on an upcoming plane trip that I can work.
You can work on that
through that. So well, so that's what's on my bookshelf. Waiting to be read.
We'll have to give us a book report on it when you're done. That sounds good. Well, David, I can't thank you enough for the invitation to come out here, but also all your work in reserving a room, setting things up. You've been a tremendous host, and I appreciate that. Not you only, but the seminary as well. So thanks also for writing this book. I'm going to read it a couple more times myself and continue to wrestle with the ideas and think about them and apply them to my own context. But most of all, thanks for taking the time today to talk to me and to expose these ideas to our community. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Glad you're here.
Yeah. And praise God. I would do encourage people to check out the seminary online. You can go to wscal.edu. We're online at reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, upcoming events, whatnot, as well as previous episodes. And stay tuned. In weeks to come, we'll continue on, I hope, with our Voss Group schedule once a month. But in terms of the gaps in between those, take a look not only for David's interview that you've watched today, but also future conversations with other professors here at Westminster Seminary, California. And look forward to other trips in weeks to come, as I'll be visiting other folks and other people, and I'm looking forward to it. So thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.